and it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, we're not alone.
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. We have Alejandro Rojas coming up in just a minute. And our guest tonight is Don Ecker, seasoned UFO researcher. And we're going to be maybe calling some people out, maybe talking about some hoaxers and some people that hang on to old beliefs. I don't know what we're going to get into, but I have a feeling it's going to be something like that. I want to thank all our supporters for supporting the show. If you want to listen to the full show and you're not listening live, you can listen to the podcast for 1 hour for free. And you can support us for only a dollar or more per month. And all that information's on Podcast UFO. I'm going to say a couple shout-outs to some new people that are $5 a month or more. And there is a Paul. He has no last name registered. Thank you, Paul. Jeff. And thank you, Jeff. And also Justin Brown said I could use his whole name. He's from Halifax, Nova Scotia. And I think he just had a sighting. He sent me something. Steve O and Dan and Bill, they're at the $10 level. Thank you so much. And so is Michael D from, no, Michael Douglas. He said I can use his whole name. And he's supporting us from Tasmania. And there's a Justin B and a Unified Field Radio. Thank you both. And a Wayne O and a Shane U. You guys have bellied up to the bar for a $25 a month subscription. And thanks a lot. And you're joining my good friend Phil, who's been there from the beginning. And I am very grateful to you all, and actually grateful to every single listener. And that is actually enough of my nonsense, and it's time to bring on Alejandro Rojas. How you doing, Alejandro?
I am doing good. You ready for some of my nonsense?
Absolutely.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're feeling better these days.
Yes, much better than I was a week ago when I was feeling yucky and my tummy was feeling a little gurgly at this time.
But, yeah, you sound chipper today, I should say.
Good.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah. So I was noticing, because I get, UFO Google alerts, and I was noticing there was some things going on this week.
Well, this is what's funny. It's the UK, really, papers have gone nutso. They've gone bonkers.
That's right. It is UK.
Yeah, all of their papers are posting, like, they're trying to outdo each other with UFO stories. Most of their stories are really crappy.
Yes, I posted one on the Facebook page because Peggy's under the weather right now. So I've been working on the Facebook page, and I did get a lot of lashback from one that was, I knew it was kind of ridiculous, but it got a lot of conversations going.
Yeah, they're usually ridiculous, and I shouldn't say they're all crap, because a lot of times, luckily, that they do seem to monitor our site, and they'll post stories regarding things that we write about. But when we go through the news today, I'm not even using one of those stories, because even though on our front page we do go through the headlines, and you can see some of the headlines with UFO stories, you'll notice that their stories are all kind of ridiculous. They're really poor videos or hoaxed videos.
Hmm. Okay, so that's great. You got some new news that's not from the UK. It's actually
new news. Yeah.
All right. So let's have it.
This first one I just wanted to mention. It's kind of an honorable mention because it's not necessarily UFOs, but it's Area 51. And this video is so much fun. So there was this guy, Glenn Campbell. And in the 90s, he was a big Area 51 researcher. This guy's really interesting. He doesn't own a home. He's a homeless person, and he's very proud of that. He always lives out of his car. He used to live near Area 51 and take videos and trying to bug the security guards and stuff like that. And did a lot of stuff on Area 51, had some really good information and photographs and stuff like that. But it's been a while since he's done this sort of work. He's still homeless, he says, but now he's an author and he's doing a lot of other stuff. Well, he went back to Area 51 to take some video just for old time's sakes, he says. And he got harassed by the security guards, and the video is really funny. So he's there, and he's on, he's not on the base, so he's on this side of the signs. And you see this truck, and as soon as he puts his camera on the truck kind of backs up and hides behind this bush. And it's really ridiculous. Like I wrote in my story about it, it reminds me of the cats. You know how a cat will kind of hide its head and think that it's hidden and you can see its entire body? It's that sort of thing. So it's really silly. So then he decided to trick him. And he went and he parked and he walked up this hill. So, and they sure enough followed. But then he backtracked on the other side of the hill, came around behind these guys in their truck. And he's filming and he's kind of giggling as he's sneaking up on them. And he gets like really close to the truck. He's practically right in front of the truck before they notice. They're just kind of blabbing away. It looks like holding a conversation and talking when he comes around. And finally they spot him and one of them jumps out of the truck and says, "Hey, you want me to take that camera?" And he runs away and he's like, "You can't take my camera." And he said that he kept running and they went their way and he went his. But the video is just hilarious. It should have a Benny Hill soundtrack behind it. But it's really good. I think that people will have a lot of fun and you can check it out. And you get a close look at those cool trucks that they drive that you see up on the hill when you go to visit the roads going to Area 51.
So that is, for the listener, that video will be linked right in our show notes, which will bring you over to openminds.tv, and you can
That's right. And I'm looking forward
to watching that myself.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You've got to see it. You'll love it.
Yeah.
Otherwise, in UFO news, actually, we wrote a lot of stuff about triangles. There's been a lot of triangular UFOs seen in the news lately, and so this is kind of interesting. So the first story I wanted to mention is this gentleman with a military background. He says that he was formerly in Navy rescue, and so he knows aircraft warning lights. But he had seen some strange lights at about 8 p.m. on June 11th that he could not explain. He got a little bit of video of them, and you see these three lights that are in a triangular formation kind of blinking strangely. Kind of an odd video. It's a pretty short video, but he was able to get a video of this, and he's just saying that, you know, he thinks it's really weird. He doesn't know what it was. And this was in North Carolina. In the story that Roger Marsh had written about this, he noted that he had contacted Sanford Davis, who is the MUFON Carolina, North Carolina investigator who looked at it, and he had closed it as an unknown. He couldn't figure out what it was, and that there was another sighting soon after, just a few days later, in the same area. Davis suggested that perhaps it was military and some kind of black project, perhaps a variation of the Astra TR-3B, which there's no evidence exists, but it's kind of a mythology out there. But still, you know, it's certainly possible. And there are, for a fact, we have found inklings of triangular-shaped secret aircraft that is out there. So there's something, whether or not it's an unconventional in nature, that's to be foreseen. However, there were another couple of triangular sightings that Roger had written about at openminds.tv. One of the more recent ones was around Kansas City, and this was a very bright light that someone had seen on August 14th. It was coming towards them. It was going slowly, it was moving fast and very close to the ground. So this person says at first it was in the direction of the airport, so they didn't think much of it. Then they parked, because it looked like this was an airplane that was about to crash. So they parked to take a look at it, and it got closer and closer, and the light actually zoomed overhead, and that's when this person could see it was actually three lights in a triangular formation. So that was kind of a weird story.
Hmm. Now, do you know if that one in particular made any noise?
Great question. It did not make any noise. That's why they thought it was a plane crashing, because there were no engine sounds, just a swooshing of air, they said, moving through the air.
You know, it's funny. A lot of times you never hear of anybody even saying that.
Yeah, you're right.
The swoosh of air.
Yeah, you're right, which is odd.
Is swoosh a real word?
Actually, they used swish, swish-like.
Ah, okay.
So I haven't Googled that to find if it's a real word. I don't think it is. But you know what's funny these days? I don't think there's an age. I remember growing up, it was not like this. When there was words added to the dictionary, it would be a big deal. There'd be a news story. You know, you'd see all about it. There'd just be a couple.
Right.
It would be controversial. These days, they're adding, you know, words like crazy. Like every word someone makes up so that it's shorter for them to tweet it, it gets in the dictionary. So I'm sure if we start using swish, in fact, especially if we started hashtagging it, we can get it in the dictionary in no time.
I think we should get on this and get it done.
One last triangular UFO sighting I wanted to talk about was seen on August 19th, and this is in the Austin, Texas area. This one's a little more exciting because it was 6:44 a.m., so it was during daylight hours. And this was a guy who says he was outside and looking at a squirrel on an apartment rooftop, which kind of reminds, that's like me in the morning. My brain takes forever to warm up. So I'm like a zombie, and that's like about as much input as I can kind of comprehend in the morning. I can see myself sitting there in the morning watching a squirrel, you know, like a dog, just watching it going back and forth. But anyway, I'm guessing that's what this guy was doing, trying to wake up in the morning. He's watching the squirrel run around, and then beyond the squirrel, he noticed a triangular-shaped object that he said was coming towards him at a high rate of speed. He said what was interesting is that the body of the object appeared transparent, like it was changing colors. It actually flew over him. He said it was cloudy, and he estimated the clouds were around 13,000 feet, so he thinks this was a bit lower than that because he could see it. But, the strange object he felt was kind of stealthy, even had some kind of color-changing properties that zoomed right over his head.
Wow. Well, is that it for this week?
That's it for this week. Triangles on parade.
I know. And it seemed like there were a couple of stories we had the week before. More and more and more.
Yeah, a lot of triangular sightings. So really interesting stuff. And I have heard from David Marler, and I should get back to him. He, of course, is a guy who wrote a book on triangles that I would recommend. You've had him on your show.
He's great.
And I guess he's got some new stuff out there, too. So, yeah.
Yeah, how
good
about
stuff.
That? All right. Well, thanks very much, and we'll be talking to you next week.
All right. Talk to you soon, buddy.
All right. Quick music break right here. We'll be right back with Don Ecker. That music is by a fan in Ireland, Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse. Thanks for that, Carrie. And before we bring Dawn in, just quickly, I'm going to be at the Experiencer Speak in Portland, Maine, this coming Friday night and Saturday, and hope to see you there. If you're listening to the show, please come find me. I'll be around. I think Saturday I might have a Podcast UFO t-shirt on. I'm not sure. But anyway, hope to hang out with you. And also, we have a phone number here, 603-967-4030 for call-ins. Make a note of that if you would. Or if you want to Skype in, it's Marty Willis, M-A-R-T-Y-W-I-L-L-I-S. Don Ecker, how are you?
Fine. How about you, Martin?
Great. And you are what I call a seasoned person. You've been at this a long time, and you have an interesting background. For the person that may not know you, I'm sure a lot or most do, but can you fill us in with your background and what your interest was, how you started having an interest in UFOs and alike?
Well, my interest in UFOs actually goes back to when I was, excuse me, a teenager. I had a rather exciting sighting in December of 1966. I'm originally from the East Coast, from Pennsylvania. I live in California now. But in December, especially during that period of time, I was in high school, and I was on a deer hunting trip with four friends. When we were coming back late in the afternoon, we were overflown by four brilliant arc light type lights. And one of my friends saw them first and yelled. And we all jumped, turned around, and these lights were, and they were not low. They were probably, I'm going to guess, somewhere between 12, 15,000 feet perhaps. But they were striking. I mean, just absolutely striking. And as they overflew us, the one light in the rear, they originally were in a diamond formation, suddenly shot straight up in the sky. So that's when I knew that there was, as far as I was concerned, you bet there was something to the phenomenon. So I guess it was in 1982, although I was not then consciously aware of it. But I was a criminal investigator, a policeman, and I had been called out to, this was in the state of Idaho, I had been called out on an agricultural crime. I had been sent out because a farmer had reported a dead cow, one of his cattle, that was only maybe 35 yards or so from the rear of his house. In other words, it had happened literally on top of his house, and it was a classic mutilation. And the guy had several kids. He was married. He had a couple of dogs. Nothing had alerted any of the dogs or himself or his family when this happened, apparently sometime during the night. So that case was never solved, and it wasn't until a number of years later. I was wounded in the line of duty, ended up medically retiring in 1986, and the following year, while I was going through physical rehab, to keep myself busy, I bought my first computer system.
Wow, that's early, 1986?
Seven.
Yeah, that's pretty early.
And then I compounded that error, Martin, by buying a modem. And I discovered CompuServe to the tune of $6.40 an hour at 300 baud. Okay, now if you don't know what 300 baud is,
you're lucky. Yeah.
That was like chiseling words into a chunk of granite, watching them scroll across your screen. But at any rate, I came across a forum on CompuServe called the Issues Forum, and there were a number of files in there on various things like UFOs, cases that at that time were current, and some cattle mutilation files. And suddenly the light went on in my head, and I said, oh, my God, that's apparently what I had been involved in. So that's basically how I got my start.
Wow. You know, there's there really is a weird subject, another weird thing to look into is the whole cattle mutilations. You know, that's come up a couple of times on shows in the past. And, you know, there's some people that have done some great research. And I thought Linda Moulton Howe, way back when, did a really good, you know, a documentary on that. And a few other people have investigated it. And some people, it comes back to a lot of people are still saying, you know, this is people that are doing this. This is, you know, it all comes back to it's kind of unexplainable, if you ask me. The incisions, the precision of all the things that are done on these animals. Now, you actually saw this with your own eyes. So what was that like?
Well, I didn't know what it was at the time. It was obvious that it was intentionally done by someone or something. Now, you know, you bring up a very interesting point, because this is something that I have stressed time and time again. If this were a human agency that was conducting these mutilations, okay, you're talking about a national or even international consortium that would have to be doing this. Why do I say that? Well, it's not located to just one small geographic area. This has been nationwide. It has stretched literally from the states of Washington and Oregon and Idaho and Nevada and Montana and Utah and Oklahoma and Texas. I mean, all across the United States. And in all the years that those cases have been reported, and we're going back 50, 60 or more years, here's the one thing to keep in mind. No one has ever been arrested or successfully prosecuted. Now, I was a law enforcement agent out here in the West. And let me tell you, when you're talking about ranchers and farmers that have cattle, you're talking about huge financial investments.
And very protective, too.
And these guys and women will not brook any interference with their animals. Mm-hmm. And that includes going out with lethal weapons, with rifles, shotguns, to defend and protect their animals. And, you know, this is just something that I could never fathom would be able to be carried on as long as it could. And if this were a human agency, someone not get shot or arrested or prosecuted. And it just hasn't happened.
I think I've heard the theory from someone that it is a government of the government is checking to see what radiation effects are having on, you know, biological entities like, you know, animals in areas. And that's why they're doing it. But that, I'm sure you've heard that one, too. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, that's not to say that it may have never happened. That is certainly, it's not something I would throw out. But it is not the only answer. It can't be.
Right. And, you know, what are your thoughts on it? I mean, you know, a lot of people think it's tied to the UFO, you know, to extraterrestrial. I mean, it's to me, I think it's just one of those unexplainables. I don't know. And in your research that you have done, were there a number of cases where there was a UFO sighting at the same time or ahead of time?
Oh, sure, sure, yeah. Sure. Now, back when I was active, and for the first, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years that I was involved with UFO magazine, that is what my research was known for, was mutilations, not only animal mutilations, but also human mutilations.
Mm.
And I wrote a number of papers that can still be found on the web about that. This is when I was really delving into this subject. Now, the various theories that I have heard over all those years are legion. For example, one of the people that that I knew very well, and I had a lot of chats with him. As a matter of fact, I interviewed him on my first in the pages of UFO magazine when my wife and I were publishing that, and also when I began my broadcast career back in 1991. Okay, I had him on the radio with me. Was noted author and Fortean researcher John Keel. Now, Keel, back in the 60s and 70s, was a prolific author. I'm sure you're aware of him, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Had written a book that, when I first read about it in the mid-1970s, I immediately went out to my local bookstore, ordered a copy. It was titled The Mothman Prophecies, because the case that he was talking about took place not very far from where I grew up at in central western Pennsylvania. The case took place in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and the Ohio Valley, which, as the crow flies, was pretty close to me. And I can recall at the time that this was ongoing, hearing about it in the news, because people were seeing a cryptozoological, apparently a cryptozoological creature that they called the Mothman down in that area. And this creature was involved in scores of cases of missing dogs. I mean, and some of this stuff is going to sound pretty crazy, but I got this directly from Keel, and he was still, at that time when I was talking to him, was still flummoxed by what he had encountered during that period of time. Talk about strange occurrences. And I think about it today, and I'll be honest, it still can give me a chill when I think about it. But this creature and the events that were happening during that period of time included, among other things, not only missing animals, livestock, and what have you, domesticated pets, but also mutilations. And we're talking about animal, you know, cows. We're talking about stuff like that. Now, Keel had a very interesting theory, and he bounced it off me. I didn't know what to think about it. And as a matter of fact, he had written about it in his book, Mothman. But he, although originally considered UFOs to be potentially extraterrestrial, finally came to the conclusion that they were not extraterrestrial. He coined the term ultra terrestrial. Now, what does that in effect mean? He thought they were interdimensional. Hmm. Now, to me, okay, alien is alien is alien, all right? Whether it comes from another star system or another dimension or another universe. I mean, I don't see, you know, what the semantics matter. You know, if you're talking about something that is coming here from somewhere else. But Keel came up with the theory that these ultra-terrestrials, with all this missing biological material, animals, blood, various other items that, you know, were missing and involved in these cases, that perhaps these entities were using them to construct biological entities to be able to operate in our domain here in our universe, on our planet. Now, one of the things that he used to support his theory were tales of the infamous Men in Black, the MIBs. Now, at that period of time, the MIBs were not, you know, Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. They were actually terrifying entities that often showed up in the event, the aftermath of UFO cases. And in one famous case that Keel talked about in his book were some people down in West Virginia that had a UFO sighting. And a day or two later, this monstrosity of a looking man showed up at their door, a huge guy. He knocked on the door, and they opened it up, and he said he was there to, if I remember correctly, and it's been a while since I've read Keel's book, but he was there to find out if they might have been heirs to somebody that had recently died. That was his excuse for getting in the house. But his suit was ill-fitting. The guy was bald, extra pale. I mean, he could have maybe passed for a vampire. And he came in, sat down. The pants that he was wearing rode up his leg. And I believe it was the wife noticed what appeared to be a green wire or cable that was inserted into his leg. Now, you know, when you hear stories like that, I mean, sure, at first blush, you go, oh, bullshit, you know. But the fact of the matter was that this was not the only case where something like that happened. And, you know, when the individual finally left their house and he walked outside, he almost immediately disappeared, gone. I mean, gone, okay? Just like he vanished into thin air. So there was something with a high degree of strangeness that was going on down there that Keel had chronicled. And, of course, he wrote, oh, my Lord, he wrote a number of books where he talked about cases like this. And that's basically where he was coming from in his explanation for why they might have been mutilating these animals and taking other items like blood. Now, I heard another theory back then about the missing blood, and this was one of the staples in mutilation cases, especially with cattle. If it was a genuine mutilation, almost invariably the blood would seemingly disappear. It was exsanguinated from the carcass. And there were stories that were floating around and even made it into the pages of numerous newspapers that there was a process where bovine blood, cattle blood, okay, could be used, the plasma at any rate, in the event of a national emergency, all right, this could be used as a blood substitute. So there were a lot of people with a lot of theories on what this all may have been. But those were just a couple of them that I came across in the years.
Well, now let's talk about your background as in law enforcement, because I'm sure that really helped you with all the type of the research you did in the following years.
Yeah, sure it did.
And is that how you conduct? Did you conduct these cases that you were researching basically the same way as you would in your profession?
Absolutely. Over the years, you know, I mean that's one knack, if I can, you know, be so specific, that I always thought was of great benefit to me. Over the years, I've interviewed and investigated hundreds. And I'm not just talking about UFOs. I'm talking about when I was involved in criminal investigations, mm-hmm. cases. where, you know, we would go out and we would be looking for a perpetrator to a crime. And the crimes ranged from narcotics to thefts, robberies, homicides, rapes. You know, it's just the whole spectrum of the types of things that, you know, that cops come across every day. And I'm not going to say I was 100% always on the money, but I could generally tell if somebody were trying to spin a story on me. And when it came to the UFO field, that was generally a great benefit. I'll never forget back when Vicky, my wife Vicky, who was the founder of UFO Magazine, and I were publishing. Our offices were in Sunland, California. And I had a very good friend. As a matter of fact, I knew many of the people in media, television, and the film industry over the years. We knew a lot of them. And a friend of mine who was a television producer who at that time was working on a documentary on the UFO topic, and I had been I had been contributing to his process, called me up and said, "Don," he said, "you're not going to believe this," he said, "but I just came across a guy who was out in the California desert, close to the Nevada border. And there's a very famous area out there, Martin, called Zizix Road, okay? And it's a very spooky spot. And a number of years ago, my very close friend and Friday night co-host on my radio show, Rich Saraday, and I had gone over to Nevada, to Las Vegas, on a thing that we were doing some investigation on. And on the way back, we had a rather amazing sighting. We had pulled off on this Zizix Road for a comfort stop, okay? And we had an amazing UFO sighting out there. This was in the middle of the night and, you know, in the desert. It was rather extraordinary. But at any rate, my producer friend told me about this guy that lived out in that area. So I said, "Well, Russ," I said, what was the story? What did the guy tell you?" He said, "Well, he didn't just tell me. He said he gave me a photograph." And I said, "Of what?" He said, "Well, this is what the guy claimed." He said he was sitting in his living room, and he was watching TV, and he had his Polaroid camera there. It was a Polaroid photograph, by the way. You know, the Instamatic thing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Shot, and it would slip out, and a minute or so later, you'd have a photo. And he said, while he was sitting there, he thought he could feel eyes upon him. And he said, he turned around and looked out the window, and he said, "What he told me, Don, was that there was a gray alien out there staring at him through the window." And he grabbed the camera and he took a picture of it. Well, I got to tell you, my BS indicator started clanging. But I said, "Okay." I mean, you never want to go into any situation, Martin, if you're an honest, legitimate researcher, investigator, and allow your preconceived notions, okay, to control what you do. I mean, that's not what an investigator does. Now, you may have suspicions, and believe me, when I heard that story, I did. But you follow it through to conclusion. So my buddy said, "I'll bring the photo over to you." And I said, "Okay." So sure enough, a day or so later, he showed up at our offices, came in, and he handed me this photograph. And I looked at it, and it was kind of a blurry image, and yeah, it sure looked like a gray. But that wasn't all. On the picture, it looked like somebody had vomited on this photograph and then wiped it off. I kid you not. So I looked at Russ and I said, Russ, I said, what is that stuff? He said, well, he said when he was eating a bowl of cereal, this is what he told me, he was eating a bowl of cereal, and when he first looked at the photograph, he said he was so shocked that he went, whoop! And he blew cereal on it. So we took that photograph, and Russ had some equipment, I had some equipment. We started examining this. And I said, well, I want to talk to this guy. And he said, well, he said he didn't want to talk to you. He said, I told him that I was going to bring it over to you, but he doesn't want to talk to you. And I said, why not? Well, he doesn't want the notoriety. Oh, okay. So we examined this photograph, and there was a magazine that somebody had sent us at the UFO offices. And this magazine was a professional oil industry magazine, okay, for the oil industry. Now, the reason they sent us the magazine was because inside this issue, okay, they had a full-page ad. Now, remember, this we're talking about 92, 93. UFOs were still fresh, exciting. Every week on television, you could find 3 to 5, 6 programs with the UFO theme. I mean, it was really the wrench that was driving the media scene back then. Shows like Oprah Winfrey, Larry King Live, mm-hmm. You know, Inside Edition, Sightings, Encounters, a Hard Copy, all these programs continuously for almost a decade ran UFO topics every week. So a lot of people were excited about it, and a lot of, you know, a lot of chatter was out there in TV land. Well, this oil industry magazine had this full-page ad which used the UFO ET theme in this ad. And, I mean, they had on the photograph a large representation of a typical gray alien. And I looked at that picture, I'm talking about in the magazine, and I looked at this photograph that Russ had brought to me, and they were identical. This guy was trying to float a hoax where he apparently had a copy of that, cut the alien out of it, okay, then threw some screens or something, shot this Polaroid photograph. And, I mean, you know, those are the kind of things that that you run into all the time. And but we were able to bust it at the source. And then I had my answer why this guy didn't even want to talk to me on the telephone, much less meet me. So,
wow.
That's the kind of stuff that we would do. And, you know, we would bust.
Yeah, well, that is an amazing one. And let's talk about when you had the magazine, what that was like. I mean, that is grueling with deadlines and everything, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it sure was. But I'll tell you, it was one of the jobs, the few jobs in my life that I looked forward to bouncing out of bed in the morning and going to work because it was fascinating. Not only did I get a chance to meet literally people from all over the globe, all around the world, okay, but some of the most fascinating cases and some of the most fascinating hoaxes you could ever hope to encounter.
Huh. Wow. And so this is going back, you know, kind of like during the birth of the Internet, about that same time, isn't it? So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd like to talk, I don't know if it's going to be this hour or next hour, about you know, all the UFO hoaxes on YouTube. I've talked to actually other longtime researchers about this and forming a group that would basically call out hoaxes, and that would be very difficult to do, especially these days, as we've all been watching technology grow and grow, and CGI, and then in today's world, it's harder and harder is what I'm getting at.
Here's the bottom line on a lot of that. Yes, you are correct. CGI today is in some cases almost indistinguishable from reality. But here's something else, and I've heard very few people mention this, okay? I was involved in a case back in the very late 1980s, very, very early 1990s, that was involved and ended up being the F-117 stealth fighter case, all right? Hmm. Now, one of the people that I knew then and was an invaluable source of technology was a guy that worked for Aerojet, an aerospace company out here in Southern California. And this guy had a bee up his bonnet about the UFO thing. And he was continuously snowing the DOD and the Air Force and other government agencies, including the CIA and the NSA, with FOIA requests. I mean, a literal snowstorm that went on for years. And this was a case that I broke in the pages of UFO Magazine and on my original radio show, UFOs Tonight, which was on the CRN network, okay? And what they did, they being the government, set this guy up with an Air Force general incommunicado and an FBI agent, came to his place of business, deliberately exposed him to classified information that he did not have a need to know, and then tried to get him fired. Okay? Now, it involved the F-117 just before the F-117 went public. So I guess they felt safe in doing that. Now, this is the kind of stuff, the red meat, that I sunk my teeth in. Now, when I was in the military, okay, I was a Vietnam veteran. I was in the military. I was involved in military intelligence. I had a top secret clearance with a crypto access. Now, all that meant was, in the course of my duties, if I had a need to know certain classified information, I could be given that classified information because it was involved in whatever it was I was doing. However, if I did not have a need to know, then that TSC clearance meant no more to me than it would to you, okay? In other words, if I didn't have a need to know, I wouldn't be shown the information. It's that cut and dried. Mm-hmm. Now, the F-117 was actually an aircraft that had its development all the way back in the 1970s. Now, my point is that aircraft technology, what we see flying around in the skies any day of the week, okay, if you think that is the cutting edge that aerospace is working on, then I'm going to let you go back to your correspondence with the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus. Because anything that we see flying, the cutting edge, and you can take this to the bank, is at least 30 years or more in advance of what you're seeing. My God, the SR-71, the Blackbird, okay, the aircraft that I used to watch flying out of Okinawa, okay, to go to North Vietnam, China, Korea, okay, was an aircraft that still today, officially, its speed record or its height that it could fly at has never been broken, although I'm sure it has. But officially, this aircraft is still faster, higher than anything else flying that was developed in the 1950s. Now, do you honestly believe that that was the cutting edge? I mean, and that was all the way back then. What we have today, for all I know, they're working on an interstellar drive. You see what I'm saying? So what we see in the sky today, it's really hard to make that distinction between what we could be flying and what somebody else is flying. Now, I heard what your co-host there at the beginning of the program was talking about.
Triangles.
Craft flying around.
Lots of them.
There have been triangle craft that has been flying around for 30-plus years in the skies above the United States and other places around the world. And these craft, and I was told 15 years ago on good authority that these were extremely advanced military flying machines that the U.S. Armed Forces were flying. Now, is that the bottom line? No, of course not. Perhaps they saw something in the sky at one point and they tried to emulate it. I mean, that's always possible also. But anything that you see flying that you think might be alien, well, you know, these days it's really hard to say.
Right. The one thing that is very puzzling, of course, you can hear people talk about they've already discovered an anti-gravity, you know, vehicle. That's why it's not making any noise. But that is the curious thing, is a lot of people that talk about these triangles that see them fairly close, all or as far as I know, mostly say that they hear no noise at all.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not surprised by that. I mean, the technology, look at our defense budget yearly.
Huge.
And I'm talking about what is publicly discussed.
I'm not talking
about the black budget, okay, that is explained away with $5,000 toilet seats and $3,500 hammers,
yeah,
you know, and a $1,000 screwdriver. You know what I'm saying, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what the black budget, I mean, I go all the way back to 1988. When George Knapp broke the first story on Area 51 publicly, okay, in the Bob Lazar saga, okay, what Lazar claimed was out there in those mountains in underground hangars. Is something like that possible? Well, as far as I'm concerned, you bet it's possible, all right? And I was involved with that story almost since the very beginning of it. And I couldn't tell you how many times I've talked to Knapp and also Lazar about that particular story. But the bottom line to take away from that, whether you believe it or not, is the fact that if the government had their hands on something, believe me, that's how they would do it.
Very well could be. You know, up on the message board, it's going to be changing gears a little, and then we're almost at the top of the hour. We got about 6 or 7 minutes or something like that. But someone wanted to find out what your relationship is or was with the Burns. A number of people were asking on the chat room.
What do you mean?
I don't know exactly what they're talking about. I guess it had to do with UFO Magazine. How did you change, you sold that basically or got out of it and they took it over.
No.
Okay. I got that wrong. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
1997. My wife and I, okay, after 11 years of publishing the magazine, we ran into financial problems. Now, the publishing game is a very hard game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and you've got to have a lot of income, because the money that you're making is not the money from the last issue published. Okay, you get a magazine out, all right, it goes out to the distributors, then it goes out to wherever the subscribers, it goes out to the places where it's distributed, and you don't see any money of that for at least the next 2 to 3 issues. So you're always running on fumes. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
The bottom line was, by 97, we were financially at the breaking point. Now, we knew Bill Burns. Bill was very interested in not seeing UFO Magazine go under. He introduced us to some media people in the Hollywood arena, okay? So we took some meetings with them, went down, and they took over the publication, all right, and kept Vicky on as the editor. I was on as the director of research. Bill was listed as a publisher, although at that time he did not have any financial considerations in it. Well, they kept it up for 5 years. And incidentally, these people, even though Vicky, my wife, and I had been heading this for 10, 11 years, all right, never wanted any input from us. Not any input. I couldn't tell you how many times we would go in there with some ideas to do this, that, or something else, and would get shot down. So I said, fine. You know, they're footing the bills. Okay, let them do it. Well, after 5 years, they basically said, well, we've lost too much money. We're going to shut the magazine down. However, if you and Vicky and Bill and his wife want to take it over, we'll allow you to keep publishing. Well, we did up until about 2006. However, up to that point, it was becoming increasingly harder and harder to work with Bill and his wife, Nancy. And quite frankly, Nancy and I had clashed on a couple of occasions over inconsequential things. I'm not going to go into that. But finally, I just had my fill of it. My wife, after 20 years, had her fill of it, and we bailed out, okay, in 2006, the very beginning of 2007. And the Burns took it on. They were going to be the sole publishers. Well, they kept missing deadlines. And the copy of the magazine for the next few issues, they didn't have any proofreaders, or if they did, they were missing stuff all the time. In the proofing of the magazine, there were a lot of egregious errors that popped up. And here was the other thing. As you can tell, I was pretty factually oriented, and I gave short shrift to a lot of these, let me think of a very polite way to say it. These pie-in-the-sky, unicorn-searching, so-called UFO researchers. And they began running a lot of copy in the magazine that I found particularly offensive. And when I say offensive, I'm talking about cases that had been disproven years before that suddenly started popping up. Now, I attributed that to the fact that Bill was an academic, okay? Nancy, who really fancied herself as an ace publisher, just quite simply didn't know the field, like Vicki and I had. And they would have things in there routinely, like the Dulce Base Shootout. Now, that's a story that goes back basically to Paul Benowitz,
right,
which could be a whole show or series of shows in itself,
mm-hmm,
okay, where this poor guy was disinformed to the point where he ended up in a mental hospital by government disinformation agents. And I don't say that in a throwaway manner. I'm talking about actual disinformation agents, all right? One of them named Rick Doty,
right,
who was with AFOSI at the time. Now, these cases were proven hoaxes, but they were now making it in pages of UFO Magazine. And I got to be honest, too. I was not quiet about it, all right? When something like that would happen, I probably should have kept my mouth shut, but I couldn't, okay? Because I saw what had been our baby going to hell. And then Nancy decided to take a year off and not publish the magazine, even though they were still taking subscriptions, okay, from people that were expecting a magazine. She took a year off to write a novel. And not long after that, the whole thing folded. So there it is,
well,
in a nutshell.
Thank you for that, Don. And we're right at the top of the hour. We're going to take a break here in a second. In the second hour, I'd like to talk to you more about how a lot of times the myths become seeming realities and why people get fed up in this field. I want to talk about that in the second hour. So that's it for the first hour. If you're listening to the podcast, you can support the show and listen to the whole show and archives of past full shows for only $1 a month or more. That information is right on our website, podcastufo.com. We appreciate every listener, regardless. If you just like listening to the first hour, that's fine too. And we'll be back next week with Ray Hernandez. I want to thank some people today, Don Ecker, for being the guest. Keith Rowland for helping us out with the live show. Peggy Shunning for managing the Facebook page. And if you want to join 23,000 or so like-minded people, like us on Facebook. And also, we have the latest UFO news going up there all the time and related stories. Again, I'll be at the Experiencers Speak this coming weekend in Portland, Maine. I hope a listener or two will join me there. That would be a lot of fun. And I want to thank Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for the music. Almost forgot. And that's it for the show. And we'll be back next week, same time. Thanks, and keep your eyes to the sky.